territory. There ain't nobody out there gonna mess with me, 'cause I'm big and hard and battle scarred and getting long in the tooth, desperate and hungry and got nothing to lose. Some rock and roll. They said, now, boy, you're gonna have to quit your howling. Staying up all night and chasing lasses by the moon. Laying up all day on the porch playing guitar tunes. Yeah, I'm alone. And I know.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is White Aryan Resistance. And this is Terrible Tommy with too much volume on his mic. Yeah, back here in north central Indiana at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. White Aryan Resistance. That's right. Oh, yeah, I had one of my associates emailed me and said that she couldn't figure it out. I kept talking about we're selling ethyl and regular out here on the pumps at the gas station. And she said, well, I thought ethyl was behind the bar. Well, do I have to explain something like that? Yeah, Ethel's a human being. She's a woman behind the bar. She tends the bar. She's got a baseball bat back there, too, for the rowdy ones. But Ethel out there on the pumps, that's that high-grade gasoline, man, you put in your Model T and go on down the road. So there you go. There's your explanation. And you ought to see some of these old weapons of mass destruction tanks and trucks when I put that Ethel in there. Boy, the gas they put out today is a lot different than back in the day. Boy, they take off like a scalded duck. And the date is September the 6th. 2014 Saturn's Day. I may play a partial Sling Blade show here a little bit. He didn't get a fresh new show to me this week like he was supposed to. But he's a busy man, so that's no problem. We got, I bet I got 100 of his shows sitting here, and they're all good. Well, me and my main squeeze went out last night, and guess what? She surprised me with tickets to a Beach Boy concert in a great big venue. There were 1,200 people there, or 1,500. Wow. And most of, at least a half of them, probably two-thirds, were over 50. And if you ever see that 1,500 over 50 people rocking out, that's a sight to behold. They put on the best concert. I'd never seen them in concert, but I've seen them on TV in concert. But boy, I'll tell you, they put on a show like you wouldn't believe. Now, there's only two of the originals left, but the rest of them that are taking up the slack are doing a damn good job, too. They had a great big video screen behind them showing all the 60s and 70s films from the beaches and the all that stuff out there in California, and took me back home because really I lived longer in California than I have any place else. And it reminded me, I landed there in 1961 with my little old Austin Healey, left the snowbound Indiana and made it into California in about a week. And 61 was when they cut their first record. That's sort of an interesting thing. I arrived in California almost to the day that the Beach Boys cut their first record. Yeah, they showed a lot of old cars and stuff down there, too. It was really great, really great, yeah. Reminded me of some of the people I met while I was in California. In fact, I only lived about a mile from the Beach Boys' home there in Hawthorne, California. I'd lived all over the beach area, West L.A., Hermosa, Santa Monica, Manhattan Beach, Redondo Beach, all down through there. As a bachelor, I sort of moved around, but then settled in North Redondo, like I say, about a mile from the home of the Beach Boys. But I never ran into them in my travels around there. I run into a lot of other people. I ran into Angie Dickinson a couple of times. We had a nice talk. Ran into Charles Bronson. I told you about that. We almost went to blows. We came within a heart with a hair's width of having a knock down, drag out, and I would have got fired from my job. And John Wayne's son, Pat Wayne, I knew him. And who else here? There was a lot of minor, you know, not big stars, but people you'd recognize that lived around the beach area, and you run into them all the time, or quite a bit. And a good friend of mine was the skipper, the captain on John Wayne's big yacht. And so I never got to meet John Wayne, but heard a lot about him. They used to cruise down to Mexico all the time. John Wayne liked it down there, I guess. And I believe, I don't know how many times he was married, but one of the times he was married to a Mexican. She was a light-skinned Mexican. I forget what her name was, but I remember that. Well, I'll tell you, those women went crazy last night at the Beach Boys concert with 1,500 people over 50 dancing in the aisles and jumping up and down and jumping on the seats. And I never seen anything. I'll tell you, I leaned over to my gal and I said, "Don't these people realize they got to be back at the home by 10 o'clock? Come on, baby." Well, let's get back to this water problem that we've got, or the whole country's got. Not content with bottling water in drought-stricken California, Nestle has added Colorado to its water empire. The world's largest food and beverage company has been draining millions of gallons of water from the Arkansas River out of a pipeline near Buena Vista. The water is taken from a pipeline and loaded into tanker trucks and taken to Nestle bottling plant in Denver. This Nestle company, same ones that screwed the people in Colombia and South America. There, the water is used to fill hundreds and thousands and millions of little plastic Arrowhead Springs water bottles, which are then trucked to convenience markets, grocery stores, movie theaters, and sports palaces around the West each month. Nestle fills roughly 40.4 million 16.9-ounce bottles. Wow. It's not just Colorado that's affected, with 65 million gallons a year being pumped out of the river. There will be long-term impacts to Colorado and downstream. The Arkansas River also flows through Kansas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, areas that have suffered major droughts recently. The Colorado proposal elicited fierce opposition from many residents who feared the company would deplete the local aquifer and that its trucks hauling the water to Denver would snarl traffic on the mountain roads. There's plenty of evidence to show that Nestle's habits are destructive of small communities. The nonprofit Stop Nestle's Waters has gathered evidence from 50 spring sites that Nestle operates around the country. And here's what they found. Nestle's predatory tactics in rural communities divide small towns and pit residents against each other. Nestle reaps huge profits from the water they extract from rural communities, which are left to deal with the damage to the watersheds. Increases in pollution and the loss of their quiet rural lifestyle because Nestle has a pattern of budgeting small communities and opponents with lawsuits and interfering in local elections to gain control of local water supplies. Nestle contributes to California water shortage big time. There you go. Now, if you think it's just out west and even the Middle West, let's go up to Maine. Nestle's subsidiary, Poland Spring, set its site on the tiny town of Fryeburg, Maine, USA, nearly a decade ago, pushing to build a huge bottling plant and take long-term control over the town's spring water. Nestle has sued the small town multiple times, arguing that its right to grow market share is more important than the town's right to self-determination. Nestle wants to lock up its control over Fryeburg's water with a contract that, including extensions, last to 2057. This lifetime contract would be unprecedented in the United States and would be a major victory for water privatization companies. Nestle's tried every trick in the trade fighting Fryeburg, relentlessly working to grind down and bankrupt opposition in the town in a wave of lawsuits. The corporations have found itself shut out of 50-year contracts. So it is pushing a 25-year contract with 4 or 5-year extensions to test the limits of how long it can lock up water before the people fight back. Nestle also has sunk deep into the Maine politics, but local activists have been fighting back and are winning victories. Earlier this year, it was revealed that every single member of the Maine Public Utilities Commission, the body that would rule on Nestle's Fryeburg fight, had connections to the corporation, forcing the commission to recuse itself from the case. This month, the entire membership of the Fryeburg Water District resigned under threat of recall. This relentless pressure is having an effect, and we need to keep up with it. There you go. There's a groundswell growing among the environmentalists, ecology people, farmers, all kinds of people are beginning to rise up. But I submit to you that it's going to take more than just trying to fight them in court, because they've got far more money than you'll ever have to fight them. Yes, you know my opinion. You know my opinion, what's going to have to happen sooner or later. And if it doesn't, there's none of these limp-wristed methods that are going to stop these people. They have to be tried by the people, put into prison, or executed. There's no other way out. Otherwise, your environment is totally going down the drain here in North America. In fact, all over the world. This is a world problem. You know, I was thinking last night during that concert, what a great time it was in America back in the 50s. A whole lot of you people remember the 50s. And you know, it's almost like, people were really having a good time and people were making decent wages and all that kind of stuff. It's almost like the ruling class said, hey, these people are too free and they're having too much fun. First of all, let's scare the hell out of them with the Cold War. Then let's concoct a no-win war that has nothing to do with anything. Send all these happy rock and rollers over to Southeast Asia to get their asses blown off and get them on drugs. You think so? They wouldn't do that? Ha! Are you kidding? I think that's one of the reasons they did it. Shipped out thousands and thousands of young white people that were going to college and everything else and having a good time doing some rock and roll. Ruling class didn't like that. Said, these people are getting out of hand. Let's get a war going, ship them out of the country and get the shit kicked out of them over in Vietnam. What do you think? Does that sound logical to you? Well, when you figure how so-called evil these bastards are, it makes perfect sense.
Well, Mexican President Felipe Calderon today said that only essential businesses such as supermarkets and hospitals should remain open. As we said, the number of suspicious deaths in Mexico is 168, but the confirmed deaths from the drug wars may exceed 10,000 in the 3 years since the Mexican government launched a crackdown on the drug cartels. Just this week, 7 policemen were assassinated in Tijuana. The drug cartels hire hitmen to do their killing. They often work for the state police and the cartels at the same time. And one who was paid as much as $20,000 per job told his story to our next guest. That's journalist Charles Bowden. After years of covering the Mexican drug wars, he says he's comfortable around killers. He once partied with 200 of them in a Mexican hotel for 5 days. But they were not interested in talking about their murders. This hitman was, which puts both of them in danger. The hitman was one of the sicarios, that's Latin for dagger, and Chuck's interview with him appears in the May issue of Harper's. Chuck Bowden joins us from WWNO in New Orleans. Chuck, welcome back to Here and Now.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and be alive.
Yeah, I would think so. A lot of what we're going to hear is graphic, and your article was written in a very almost Raymond Chandler style, you know, as you wait for the call that directs you to this interview. So just one quick question first about the writing. Do you ever worry about how, in trying to get across this depravity that you've been witnessing for years now, you're, romanticizing it? Or are you trying to strip it bare to reveal it?
Look, if I wrote that story any flatter, it would look like Kansas.
Yeah.
That I just wrote down what he said and what he did. And if you think that's romance, I don't want to date with you. You can make the argument that any time you write reality without any defense, you're writing a kind of pornography. I don't agree with it, and I'll give you an example. In 2008, 1,607 human beings were slaughtered in the city of Juarez. During that same period, only 18 people died in neighboring El Paso. A lot of the killing is done by men exactly like the sicario, the killer, in this piece. And I think it's time we smell the coffee and face reality. The second thing I wanted to convey in that piece was this wasn't a mafia guy or something. This guy was a state policeman trained by the U.S. FBI and a comandante in the state police in the state of Chihuahua. He represents the reality that American politicians who are brain like jackasses now about fixing Mexico won't face. That there is no war in any real sense between the government of Mexico and the drug people. It's a seamless web of an industry that supplies the United States with a bunch of chemicals that make us happy in the evening. What he is a jolt of reality.
Yeah.
The barbarism in the piece, I can neither apologize for or get away from. This is the life. The police come. they take you. You're taken to a place and tortured for days, weeks, or months. You're eventually murdered. You're put in a secret grave. Nobody ever knows what happens to you. This guy did that for 19 years. He is not a freak. He is the way things operate. Now be calm.
Well, let's get to it. The story of how he becomes a part of this police infrastructure is astonishing. He's a teen. He's enlisted, and he soon finds himself, as you said, driving police cars and carrying out kidnappings. He was sent to an FBI school?
Yes, in the United States. We trained him. He told me the training was very good. I said, what did they train you on? He said, how to find stolen cars, how to find drugs, and how to detect guns, which, of course, were all things he was doing.
Right. They were supplied, the cadets at the police academy, he says, supplied with liquor, drugs, women. But tell us just a little bit, an anecdote of, you know, how the police would work to carry out the ransom kidnappings.
I should mention this guy was in charge of the anti-kidnapping squad in Ciudad Juarez at one point.
Let's be clear, the anti-kidnapping squad.
The anti. He would get a call from a superior whom he never knew, be told the assignment. He would then go pick up the person, you know, as a state policeman. They would then be taken to a secret house. They would then be tortured. Their family would then pay a fortune to get them back. Meanwhile, he told me in 98% of the cases he worked on, you killed the person almost immediately. Then you get the money. Often the families would call saying that their loved one was missing. And they would be calling the very people that took their loved one, the state police. He was paid by the state government of Chihuahua, but his real money and everybody he worked with came from a bank account in El Paso. They got a monthly check. He assumed that was from the cartel. But one of the facts of this life is you never ask questions, meaning the life he was in. In fact, he does this for 18 or 19 years, and by the end, he never knows which cartel he actually worked for.
Right.
And this is a guy who was issued his own plane and his own pilot so he could fly around the country doing killings.
Yeah.
He had a set of uniforms, so he was the proper agency wherever he landed. He would land and be given police cars from that jurisdiction. This is the face of the state.
Yeah.
And by state, I mean government.
You have mentioned several times torture. Again, this is very graphic. This won't be for every listener. But it's important to hear, I think, that we're not talking about somebody yelling at someone.
His victims would have been happy to be waterboarded. Yeah, we're talking about, I pour fuel on your T-shirt. I light the petroleum on your T-shirt. I carefully monitor it so it just burns a hide off your back. I have a doctor there in case you pass out, because it would be no fun torturing you if you're unconscious, who injects you to keep you awake. There's one scene in the piece involving two DEA informants where he does this for 3 days and three nights. And then they finally manage to die before they can go into the fourth day.
For a while, you write, the organization that he was working for would offer Colombian neckties. This is the throat being cut and the tongue pulled through the slit.
Well, it's cut the throat, slip the tongue through it. They also, because, you know, they get television, they saw a necklacing in South Africa. I put a tire around your neck and then light it, burn your head off. They were doing that for a while in the 90s. He told me the trick in torturing is to not overdo it, because if you overdo it, people become insensitive to pain.
Chuck, are you sure? I mean, are you convinced that everything he was saying was true and not bravado?
Yeah, I'm certain to start with. Unlike the listeners here, I had the advantage of being with him. He's actually a rather unassuming person. The second thing is, I checked him out. In fact, I have a close Mexican friend who knows the mentor of this killer.
That's Chuck Bowden. His story about this killer who committed murder for the drug cartels is in the May issue of Harper's. When we come back, how both the hitman and the journalist try to leave the violence behind. And later today, tomorrow, with Chuck Bowden, who, after an elaborate dance, landed an interview in Juarez, Mexico, with a hitman, a man who kidnapped, tortured, and killed for the drug cartels, a trade he learned while working for the Mexican State Police. Now this man has found God and wants to talk. His story is in the May issue of Harper's. And Chuck, before the break, you said you believed him because you have 20 years reporting on these stories of the drug violence in Mexico. You've seen the carnage on the other end. You've seen the effects of his work.
Well, yeah, it's horrifying.
Yeah.
I've been at three death houses, and I should explain to the listeners, a death house is a house you're taken to after you're abducted, then you're tortured and killed and buried in the yard. One had 12 corpses, one had 9, one had 36 corpses. And when I asked the subject, the sicario or killer, he said there were hundreds of them in the city. He told me he personally dug 250 graves in the city, and he could lead me to 600 bodies. And he also told me he had no idea how many people were like him, that he knew he was just in a cell. He was one little part of an organism, that he knew, had no idea who he worked for. He didn't know how anything really operated. He was not a big guy. What he was extremely intelligent. That before he met me, which took a lot of, let's just say, negotiation, I'd go there and he didn't show up. He finally shows up and he's got 10 pages, single space, to print out from the internet about me. And he slaps it down on the table. And of course, I relax then because mainly I realized the guy was really intelligent. But what he was telling me was, if you welch on me, if you, turn me in, I know how to find you. So that was the way we began, oddly enough, kind of relaxed.
Well, it's sort of the
got
way...
got a little worse after that.
Well, I was going to say, it's sort of the way you left, too, because this is a man who tells you one of the reasons he's talking to you is that somewhere along the way he got God. But as he said, I have God. God frees me, to speak to you, but I remain a wolf. I can't become a lamb. And as you part, you pray when you part. You hug each other and pray, but then you notice he does something as you're both walking away.
He would meet me, and we'd drive around. He'd just point to a motel, and I'd go in and rent a room. And when we leave, I'm walking through the parking lot after we've had this prayer, which I must say I believe was sincere. I could feel almost vibrations coming through him as he prayed because he had his arm around me. I noticed him automatically memorizing my license plate on my car. And that's the part where he's a wolf. He can't turn it off. There's a $250,000 contract on his head.
Why is that? Why is that?
One of the cartels. Because he offended the son of a boss. And so he's a dead man walking. He knows they will find him. He was one of them. The final thing you have to know about him is he'll be very hard to kill because he's a killer. You could take on an army with a fountain pen. He's a professional. As this guy told me, he discovered one day that he'd spent almost 20 years working for Satan. Now he's, trying not to kill. He's trying to have a straight life, get up, go to work, etc. But he knows in his heart he's killed too many people that eventually he will be murdered. That's the cross that he's crucified on.
Why did he become what he is? You say he says it was a way to live, that he's not a victim of poverty, even though it sounds as if, he was a family of 12 kids. Why?
Okay, I'll tell you what he thinks. He got through high school by being in a gang, and the gang ran drugs into El Paso for the cartel. And then he gets out of high school and starts college and can't afford to. The state police come to him and recruit him, basically to be part of their criminal organization. Once he gets in, he has to kill. His first killing he was ordered to do, and when he did it, the state police said, "You have passed the test." Then he discovered he had a capacity for it. Now, he says a lot of what happened to him he can't remember because the way he kept on killing was a healthy diet of Jack Daniels and cocaine for about 15 or 20 years. But what I found is when I got down to specifics, if he'd tell me he couldn't remember something and I went back to it, he remembered everything. And he actually wanted the story published because in his eyes it's an act of redemption. And the redemption is if it's published, other people that are doing what he's doing will think they can leave too. My goal was to get this on paper. If we're going to have a policy toward Mexico, we should have a reality of what's going on there. I'll give you an example. Every month or two, if you read the Mexican press, you find out some key official close to the president of Mexico has been found to work for a cartel. But you never read a story where the government of Mexico has a key source next to a cartel. The other thing you should notice in this war, where 10,000 people have died since December of 2006. Very few soldiers have been killed. A lot of Mexicans have died, but it's a very odd war. You have a bunch of trained killers like the Sicario, but the soldiers seem immune. What I'm suggesting is you'll never understand what's going on there if you think it's a war against drugs. It's a war for drugs.
That's Chuck Bowden. Chuck, by the way, you talk about how the hired killer that you spoke to was, he had a cross to bear. What about yours? You have published two books on this. In 95, when you were writing, murders were about 200 to 300 a year. In 2008, as you said, there are up to 1,607 Mexicans killed. You write, you are a prisoner of all this killing.
I'm trying to escape. Now, I'm bringing out a book next year on this war of violence with more on the Sicario. But that's my farewell note. I'm in New Orleans and my life is etouffee and gumbo.
Chuck Bowden. Do you have a name for the forthcoming book, Chuck?
Miss Sinaloa.
Miss Sinaloa.
Miss Sinaloa was a beauty queen who went to Juarez to party with the police and was gang raped for 3 days. And then she went insane.
All right. That's the title of his forthcoming book. His latest book is Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing, and his story, The Sicario, A Juarez Hitman Speaks, is in the May issue of Harper's. And Chuck is speaking to us from New Orleans. Thanks.
Well, you've got to understand, boys and girls, that when this thing really gets going, these are the kind of people you're going to you're going to have to come up against, these cartels and so forth. And you know what's going to have to happen. It's either you or them. I guess we could call them future death squads. One thing you got to understand, it's something that the people who colonized the West and moved West understood. You're dealing with a mongoloid brain, and they are expert at torture. And settlers found that out real fast moving West. So, if you don't want to accept the fact that that's the way it's going to have to be, you better go someplace else real fast and hide, because that's coming, baby. It's coming. Well, we got all these Christian doctors going over to Africa. Now we had two of them that survived Ebola, and they're thanking the baby Jesus. It's the baby Jesus that helped me survive. He was directly involved. Well, the Christian religion is interesting because of the way it calls for, if you give obedience to the Christian religion, then you're going to, when you die, you're going to go to heaven or someplace not much different than the Arabs with their going to paradise with their 39 virgins. Actually, I think the Christians would be using that if they'd have thought of it first. But these people are going over there, and now there's millions of people that need help in this country, in North America. And most of them are, many of them are white. Why aren't these doctors staying here and taking care of our people? They're going over to commit a crime against nature. Yeah, it's a crime against nature to keep people alive that are unfit. Not that you should go out of your way killing them, like the military-industrial complex does. But nature takes care of these problems of overpopulation and so forth, and that's the way it should be. But the modern white race, or at least a percentage of it, has decided that they need to intervene against nature. Of course, the Bible really is very anti-nature anyhow. You understand that, I hope. And one of the things that the Christians want to do is outdo nature. which, of course, will never happen. But when I see people going over that say they're Christians, especially white people, into a black country that needs to be naturally taken care of, and they interfere and cause the survival and increase of population in a population that's starving to death, and there'll just be much, many more people to survive. Actually, they're biocriminals, I guess, or genetic criminals, or whatever you want to call it, because they're going totally outside the natural order, keeping people alive that should not be kept alive. But again, these same people could, if it wasn't for their Christ insanity, stay in North America and work real hard to treat white people and even non-whites in this country, you know, even the blacks. I mean, you know, why don't they go down to the black areas of Chicago and open up field hospitals and treat these people? No, they bought into the fact, or the, not into the fact, but into the nonsense and into the myth that of the baby Jesus. But most of them only read what they want to read. They don't read the real viral, horrible things that the New Testament says. Now, yeah, I said New Testament, not just Old Testament, New Testament. To where there's all kinds of killing proposed, and even Jesus talked about it. I come bringing a sword. I'm going to kill people. So anyhow, the mythology of Christianity and all the Abrahamic religions are anti-nature, and in the long run they will always fail, but in the short run they're going to get a lot of people killed. Lots and lots of people killed. Well, you got to watch these Turkey boys. A shop in downtown Istanbul, Turkey, posted a sign on its window front announcing that Jew dogs are banned from entering, local Jewish newspaper Salom said. The discriminatory banner, which was spotted on Thursday, says, quote, "The Jew dogs cannot come in here," unquote, and features an image of an Israeli tank. The store, located in Tahtakhale, in an area where many Jewish businesses are situated, sells mobile phone accessories. Well, so I guess some of the Turks are a little upset with the Jews. Well, let's check in with Slingblade here. This is one of his past shows, since he doesn't have a fresh show today. And remember, any phone numbers and so forth that come up on here, they're likely to be not any good anymore. So here we go with Sling Blade, and some of the material may be dated because this may have been recorded quite some time ago. So let's check in on Sling Blade.
What a passage from Which Way Western Man by William Gailey Simpson. He says here, "Such are the people who say and feel in their hearts, we already know what is good and just. We possess it also. Woe to those who still seek thereafter." And it was precisely these people whom Nietzsche pronounced the greatest danger to the whole human future. He declared much, as Jesus had before him, that whatever harm the wicked may do, the harm of the good is the harmfulness of all. I've heard that before. I think Dr. Revelo talked about that. The good that do-gooders do may actually be worse than the evil that evil men do. Okay, whatever the harm the world maligners may do, the harm of the good is the harmfulest harm. For they are the Pharisees, and the Pharisees must they be. Moreover, he whom deviseth his own virtue, he goes away of his own, meaning a man who is a law unto himself, which is unfolded from within himself. Him must the Pharisee ever crucify, for he makes the very earth they stand on to rock by asking what is good, and breaks up the old tables and the old values by setting up a new good, which is above and beyond the old. Jesus had only to say, Moses and the prophets told you so and so, but I tell you otherwise. And except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. And after that, the good and just went out and put their heads together to destroy him. To them must such a man ever give their most ever seem their most deadly foe and a veritable demon. And ever will they cry, give us Barabbas rather than this Jesus. Better the malefactor who only breaks our laws than this innovator who only breaks it but also supplants it. Thus we conclude the reading of Which Way, Western Man. A person who not only breaks the laws, but comes up with a law of his own, is the most dangerous man. If you're not a sheep, you're dangerous. You're more dangerous if you can see through the lies and the BS that the system puts out. You're more dangerous than even a pedophile. I think I've come to the conclusion that pedophiles have more respect in this society than white racialists. It sure seems that way. Am I wrong? I don't know. Alright. Let's delve into our paranoid self, because they are out to get you. Here's a quote from a letter from a Confederate camp in 1864. The Yanks have put up spectacles on rifles. There isn't no way to avoid a bullet from a mile away. Talking about the sniper. Sniper's Guide to Dealing with FLIR-Equipped Adversaries. FLIR, I believe, I haven't read this yet, but FLIR, I believe, stands for Forward-Looking Infrared. It's what's mounted under the bottom of police helicopters. It's where when you're running from police, helicopter pilot can direct them because he can see you no matter how many bushes you hide behind in the darkness of night. Okay, as an electrical utility thermographer or thermographer, never heard of that, I might shed some light, pun intended, on the subject. To qualify this, I am using the latest, I think, commercially available FLIR product, and am a level 2 thermographer. Total formal IR training. 2 weeks experience using IR equipment. About 5 years. Infrared IR. I believe I am the least familiar with IR. Granted, my life is not depending on avoiding IR detection, so I guess I can have my opinions pretty safely. These are my observations about infrared imagers using civilian equipment and are just my opinion. It's up to you and yours to check them out in your world. This is way brief, believe it or not. Anyone interested can email for more. This is about thermal detection, not infrared illuminating sources for starlight scopes. Infrared is not X-ray. Hollywood be damned. It cannot detect a differential heat image through common solid materials. Plastic film, black or otherwise, being an exception. However, a good imager system can see through holes in a masking material. IR masking, camo net. If you guys don't know what a camo net is, they used to erect camo nets over vehicles, like tanks and jeeps and trucks. So when enemy flybys, scout planes fly over, they have a hard time seeing if there's any equipment on the ground. And they're supported above the tank, armored personnel carrier, truck, whatever. It's kind of like a tent in a way, but you can drive in and out from under it. I mean, we had that down to a science in our station at Fort Hood. can erect it in minutes and tear it down in minutes. Okay. All right. However, a good imager system can see through holes in the masking material, camel net. If you are inside a dumpster, body heating the bad guys, if you are inside a dumpster, body heating the bad guy's side, he can see the hot spot on the dumpster's outside. But if you are not leaning heating materials, but if you are not leaning heating against that side, he can't see you. Your body heat will not be detected behind most readily available unholed blinding materials if you are not differentially warming or cooling those materials by allowing your own IR to reflect off of something behind you, over you. But if the shielding materials are alien to the surroundings, the material itself will probably stand out. He's saying if you're inside a dumpster and you're leaning against the side of the dumpster that's within physical view of the person using infrared, he may see you because your body heat is heating up that portion of the metal. You're talking about using materials that may stand out, like if you're using thick plastic or something like that as a screen in a green forest, it's going to stand out. Even green plastic, you know, because plastic has shine to it, whereas some vegetation won't. All right, glass will not allow your thermal image to transmit pass through, same as the dumpster scenario. The lens of IR images are made of exotic, non-glass materials because of this. Every eyepiece, cluster of matter, cluster in parentheses, including gases, emits IR if it is above absolute zero, minus 459.69 degrees Fahrenheit. The warmer a body gets, the more IR it will emit. Eventually, it will enter the visible spectrum as it gets red hot. The surface of a piece of matter is where IR is emitted. Altering an object's surface will alter the rate at which IR is emitted. Stove black is a classic example. Materials physically different from each other will likely emit IR at different rates, but the differences may be very slight. If I'm not explaining this clearly, or if I'm not representing this material well, I hope one of you technical savvy guys like DC or Computer Man will chime in. Okay. Infrared imaging, red detection, depends upon two objects having one or more differences in temperature. Emissivity, meaning emitting heat, and reflectivity, and absorption of the compared objects. For this application, we can forget about absorption, and you shall all understand temperature. Now, E plus R equals 100%. Thus, the more emissive a surface is, the less reflective. If two dissimilar objects are at the same temperature, a high E will look hotter to an IR imager than a low E, thus forming an image. Let me read that again. If two dissimilar objects are at the same temperature, a high E will look hotter to an IR imager than a low E, thus forming an image. I guess I know when we used the ISUs on the Bradley when I was in the Army, if you turn up the sensitivity too high, then everything will look hot. I wonder if he's talking about that, because sometimes we have to turn it down a little bit so the actual heat source can be defined. Objects with different temperatures and the right E's could look the same, thus forming no image. Two objects with similar temperatures and similar emissivities will present an unclear, poorly defined image. Herein lies your IR strength. Here are some emissivity values for a few materials. All are in percents, all plus and minus a point or two. These are for short wavelength commercial imagers and may vary slightly for long wavelength, long range military / law enforcement equipment. Military techies should have similar emissivity tables for your equipment. And I guess these are some of the materials that have an emissivity value to it. Human skin, when you have two dots, one over the other, I know it's not a semicolon, I forgot what that's called, but they have that symbol and then the number. So, all right, human skin 97, black vinyl electrical tape 97, surface sprayed with Dr. Scholl's aerosol foot powder 96, water 95, rubber black and hard 94, glass smooth 94, plywood and raw lumber 90 to 95, most painted surfaces non-aluminum paint 90 to 95, aluminum based paints depending on formula 30 to 50. So I guess that would have a low emissivity of heat, aluminum-based paints. Oxidized, blue, parkerized, in parentheses, whatever that is. Oxidized, blue, parkerized steel around 90. Snow, 82 to 85. Most organics, vegetation, around 80. Cloth, or cotton cloth. Actually, it has cotton and then L-O-T-H, cotton loaf. I don't know what that is. Untreated, around 80. Sand, 76. Clay, 40. Gravel, 38. Aluminum, bare and shiny. Red space blanket.
Well, I'm afraid that the Sing Blade is losing me here, Ben. I'll tell you, that's getting a little bit too technical for me. Maybe not for you, but I'm afraid we're going to move on from that particular lecture. Well, let's listen to a little bit of the Great American Lie Machine. Yeah. The government does one thing very good. They lie.
So they have a really delicate balance to walk between keeping us relatively fearful, but not so fearful that we stop what we're doing and really examine how it is that they've been waging.
There are a lot of people who lie and get away with it. And that we will in fact find weapons or evidence of weapons programs that are conclusive.
I don't think we'll discover anything myself.
It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not.
Know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north.
Well, first of all, I haven't lied.
There are a lot of people who lie and get away with it.
Talking about lies and your allegation that there was bulletproof evidence of ties between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. Was that a lie?
Intelligence gathered by this and other governments leaves no doubt that the Iraq regime continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised.
Are people going to find out the truth? And the truth will say that this intelligence is good intelligence, no doubt in my mind.
I don't know anybody that I can think of who has contended that the Iraqis had nuclear weapons.
And we believe he has, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons.
Saddam Hussein is determined to get his hands on a nuclear bomb.
We cannot wait for the final proof.
He's got him. He's got him.
The smoking gun.
He's got him.
It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
Colin Powell didn't lie.
My colleagues, every statement I make today is backed up by sources, solid sources. These are not assertions. What we're giving you are facts and conclusions based on solid intelligence.
He has not developed any significant capability with respect to weapons of mass destruction. He is unable to project conventional power against his neighbors.
Are people going to find out the truth?
I have not suggested there's a connection between Iraq and the 9/11.
You have said in the past that it was, quote, pretty well confirmed.
No, I never said that.
Okay.
That's absolutely not. What I said was, it's been pretty well confirmed that he did go to Prague and he did meet with a senior official of the Iraqi intelligence service.
Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists.
including members of Al-Qaeda. Secretly and without fingerprints, he could provide one of his hidden weapons to terrorists or help them develop their own.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing!
He said there were three main reasons for going to war in Iraq. Weapons of mass destruction.
Saddam Hussein has gone to elaborate lengths, spent enormous sums, taken great risks to build and keep weapons of mass destruction.
The claim that Iraq was sponsoring terrorists would have attacked us on 9/11.
Before September the 11th, many in the world believed that Saddam Hussein could be contained.
And that Iraq had purchased nuclear materials from Niger.
The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb.
All three of those turned out to be false.
First, if I might correct a misperception, I don't think we ever said, at least I know I didn't say, that there was a direct connection between September the 11th and Saddam Hussein.
Who does the president think he's kidding?
Of course, it was information that was mistaken.
There are a lot of people who lie and get away with it.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere. Nope, no weapons over there. Maybe under here.
When you have a precedent set like that, and you have somebody, George Tenet, acknowledging in his book that he knew that the administration was deceiving the American people into a situation that is murdering young men and women from this country and others, that George Tenet and Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice and George Bush et al. Should be in jail.
Yep, the great American lie machine. They're all goddamn liars. They're all mass murderers. And every one of them, Cheney, Bush, Rice, Wolfowitz, all of them, should be in prison or hung by the neck until dead. Well, we're slowly moving towards that third world position. Yeah. And filling it up with people who know how to survive in the third world. But do you know how to survive? Let's see how this progression is moving along.
Front page headline of the Nogales International newspaper from Friday. County cuts service. 879 streetlights to turn off. To save $90,000, cash-strapped Santa Cruz County in Arizona has decided to turn out the lights, to let 879 streetlights go dark. Times are tough right now, like they are everywhere in the country, and this is Santa Cruz County's effort to tighten its fiscal belt. They are shutting off the lights. And you know, it's not just Nogales, Arizona, that is experiencing darker-than-normal nights right now. Last year, the city of Santa Rosa, California, decided to do the same thing. They removed 6,000 streetlights and turned off another 3,000 more after midnight, an effort to save the city $400,000. Earlier this year, officials in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, shut off more than 3,000 of their streetlights. Colorado Springs, Colorado, turned off about 8,000 of theirs. Colorado Springs has also dropped more than 40 of its police officers. And I kid you not, they have auctioned off their police helicopters. Not because crime is over, wahoo, in Colorado Springs. It's because they're broke. Philadelphia has decided to shut down 3 fire companies every day and 3 every night. Rolling firefighting brownouts in order to try to save Philadelphia some cash. The Wall Street Journal reported recently on the growing number of places across the country where local governments are unpaving the roads. They are turning paved roads into gravel roads because paved roads are too expensive to maintain. It's not one little town's wacky Luddite solution. It's happening in North Dakota, more than 100 miles of road in South Dakota, in 38 counties in Michigan, and it's happening in Ohio, and it's happening in Alabama, and it's happening in Pennsylvania. Which means that somewhere in China, it is entirely possible that a business person sat down for a ride on a 200-mile-an-hour, state-of-the-art, levitating bullet train and cracked open the Wall Street Journal and read about how, in America, we've decided we can't afford paved roads anymore. Consider also Clayton County, Georgia. Clayton County, Georgia decided to solve its budget crisis by ending its public bus service. Not cutting back the number of buses, not suspending certain bus routes, but just shutting down its bus service altogether. More than 8,000 people who rely on that bus service every single day to get to work or school, they are totally out of luck. Speaking of school, that is where the state of Hawaii has decided to look to for an answer to its budget woes. Public schools in Hawaii have been implementing a 4-day school week, just not opening schools on Fridays. Hawaii schools closed their doors on 17 Fridays over the past school year. Just make do, moms and dads. How are you going to deal with the child care issue? Hawaii, of course, is the home state of President Obama, who made the case today that shortchanging education, doing things like, say, cutting down the number of school days, is actually counterproductive to keeping the U.S. economy going.
The single most important thing we can do to make sure we've got a world-class education system for everybody. That is a prerequisite for prosperity.
Education is the economic issue of our time.
If education is the economic issue of our times, then how exactly is our economy affected by just lopping a whole day of instruction off the school week? How exactly is our economy affected by 46,000 education jobs being lost over the past 3 months? In order to prevent more of that, in order to prevent things like cops and firefighters being laid off and streetlights being shut off, something extraordinary is happening in politics this week. Members of the House of Representatives are returning to Washington during their August recess to vote on emergency funding for states and local governments, a $26 billion state aid bill that will, among other things, prevent thousands of teachers from being laid off, which is, if you ask Tea Party activists, it's a horrible idea to try to stop teachers from being laid off. Tea Party activists have reportedly planned protests against the aid package in at least a dozen states. The Hill newspaper says, quote, "The activists are upset over $10 billion in the package for a fund to stop teacher layoffs. They argue that states have hired far too many teachers in the last decade, and they should be downsizing the pool of teachers rather than asking for a federal bailout." Oh, see, it's a bailout now. That's the argument. Class sizes are too small. We need to fire some more teachers, America. Apparently agreeing with the Tea Partiers are House Republicans, the vast majority of whom are expected to vote against that state aid bill tomorrow. Earlier today, soon-to-be former Republican Congressman Pete Hoekstra of Michigan tweeted this, quote, "On the way to D.C., vote on more deficit/stimulus spending. Spending is destroying America. Time to stop. I'll vote no." The number three House Republican, Mike Pence, stated his opposition to the bill this way.
"I have to tell you, I think the American people are tired of more spending, more bailouts, and I think they're going to be frustrated with Congress coming back from a recess when we should be listening to the American people to do more of the same.
For the record, Mike Pence, along with a number of other Republicans, are now railing against this state aid bill for teachers and cops and firefighters, while simultaneously arguing to extend the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. Against the state aid bill, which, by the way, is totally paid for and wouldn't be added to the deficit.
Well, do you get the picture? Do you know that last year the 3% at the top, the ruling class, made 20% more profits? That you're going to turn your roads into dirt? Yeah. Now remember, all this money first has to be taken from the states. And then these people go to Washington to beg to get money back. First of all, it has to come from the people, come from the workers in your state. In other words, it's robbed, it's taken to Washington, it's squandered onto warfare and occupation, all that kind of stuff. And then you have to go to Washington to beg to get some of it back that was yours in the first place. 3% of the people got very fat last year, but they're turning your lights off. How much do you think that's going to affect the crime rate in places like Chicago and L.A. and Detroit and all over the place when you turn the lights out? Oh, boy, Katie, bar the door shut. There's a man under the bed. That's it for today. Saturn's Day. I'll be back with you on Moon's Day and 14-5 and... shut up and keep your powder very, very dry.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?
Just sing a song and dream the sunny weather.
Happy trails.